And the ghettos play long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true. Will always love you no matter what you do.
To say no to the silencing of our voices.
Don't let a misguide you. They'll have you acting like the sun don't shine and the sky ain't ever blue. But you know and I know it's all about survival. The struggle of our people is like that unrivaled. Fuck politicians, they was never in control.
Never.
It's deeper than that. A true battle. What they want is to bring us to our knees, so my people guard your life by any means.
This is for those who know we all gon' die. You're set up that way by infinite power. Those who know the feel of chains in the belly of the beast and the mental strength. This is for those who have their own fallen angels trying to find the way home. This is for everybody and
welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday on the month at CKUT 90.3 FM. It is just after 6 p.m. It's the last Wednesday of the month, February 27th. We have another jam-packed program this evening, starting off with an interview conducted by May Nam, our beloved May in Toronto, with sex educator and burlesque performer Lorraine Hewitt.
In honor of Black History Month, Alyssa Clutterbuck will be reporting on Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and the Supreme Court's decision from today. Malek Yalouie brings us a report on the sexual assault and acts of violence against women in the Tahrir Square protests and the worldwide day of action that took place this month as a response and call for action to end the violence.
We also welcome back feminist writer and critic Christiana Collison as our in-studio guest. Mercedes Bonaire will be interviewing Christiana on her recent piece, Complicating Space, Safe Space and the Politics of Privilege and Marginality, which was published earlier this month in the McGill Daily. Thanks for being here, Christiana. All this coming up on the next Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio.
My name is May J. Nan, and today I'm here with Lorraine Hewitt, also known as Coco La Creme, who is a sex workshop instructor and burlesque performer in Toronto. Hello, Lorraine.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start first with talking about sexual education and how you started, you know, doing that kind of work.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a funny story because there is no
of course, really obvious path to doing sex education. Mm-hmm. It really started for me with having a dissatisfying sex life. I was not taught by my parents about sex. They really were afraid of the subject. They didn't mention anything. In fact, I remember once asking my mother what an orgasm was, and she told me, don't ever say that word again. I of course got sex ed in public school, but it was mainly about how not to get pregnant, how not to catch diseases, and there was really very little about consent, about what feels good and what doesn't, about how to enjoy sex, or that even that sex should be enjoyable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I found myself thus equipped, going out into the world, having sex with partners, and not understanding how to bring my body to orgasm, not feeling comfortable with the people that I was with, and, you know, to talk to them about what felt good and what didn't, for them or for me. Mm-hmm. And I really was dissatisfied with that. I really wanted to change that situation and find out what everyone was talking about, what made sex so great for everyone else. What I did was, luckily, I had at that time, that was in my early 20s, I had at that time a really fabulous community of people around me who were really sex positive and really encouraged me to explore. And it made a lot of possibilities feel like they were possibilities, right? I didn't feel too cut off from exploring things. So I went to my local sex shop, and I bought things, and I went to workshops, and I talked to everybody about sex, and I just really was like, I need to know as much as I can. I need to really gather this information and put it into use. And I ended up going to my local sex shop so often that they offered me a job one day.
Okay. Is this good for her?
Actually, no. This was another shop in Toronto. Mm-hmm. But they also have, like, a great kind of attitude, a sex-positive sex shop. Mm-hmm. And from there, I was talking to people about sex every day, and I was... you know, I was exposed to a community of sex educators, mm-hmm. who were all really willing to share their knowledge with me and mm-hmm. Helped me to, like, grow and learn over the years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I started with Good for Her about 9 years ago, mm-hmm. and have been teaching workshops with them ever since.
Mm-hmm. And what are the workshops that you specialize in?
I teach a few of them now. So there is the Kissing for Couples workshop. Mm-hmm. I also do one on romantic sex. That's also for couples.
Okay.
Yeah. I do a flirting one for singles. Mm-hmm. As well as I do my burlesque class, because mm-hmm. I'm also a burlesque performer. Mm-hmm. Giving Great Head is another class that I teach.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I feel like I'm forgetting some of them now. But there's a number of them now.
I totally relate with you when you talk about how when I was in high school, for example, I had these workshops where the message was, don't get pregnant, don't get an STD. And I mean, that's like a real buzzkill, I think, mm-hmm. when you're 16 or 17. But you see sexual education, the kind of sexual education you do, as something that you think should be taught in schools, or what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you get into a really tricky area there, because mm-hmm. a lot of parents are not going to want to teach a pleasure-based style of sex education mm-hmm. in their schools. I mean, some people do. I see that there are some parents who really do want that for their kids and maybe provide it for them, or there is the Unitarian Church has a really comprehensive sex education program for their youth.
Oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. They bring them to sex shops. They talk to them about everything.
Yeah.
And what I would like to see, the curriculum open up a bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, if they could not do the sex education in such a heteronormative way, for one, mm-hmm. that would be mm-hmm. super helpful. And I think people are wanting to bring that in, but it's still kind of challenging to
yes.
change the way that curriculum has been taught
yeah.
for so long. I also think that, you know, if we could even just say to people that sex should feel good mm-hmm. and really talk to them truly about consent and
yeah.
about how nuanced that is,
yeah.
I think that is something that is totally appropriate
yeah.
for young people to learn.
Well, I don't remember learning anything about consent,
no.
actually, when I was in high school.
And you know what? young people do not understand consent. You know? Yeah, exactly. It takes a long time to figure it out. And some of us never figure out really what that's all about. I think that's a really valuable thing. And I feel also that if somebody had told me when I was young that sex should feel good and that I should demand that it feel good, mm-hmm. that would have made a big difference as to who I would have slept with. Mm-hmm. So while I can't see parents approving, you know, a class like Giving Great Head in high school, I think just getting away from the scariness of it, uh-huh. and showing folks that, yes, this can be good, but let's be practical, let's be realistic, and let's not just talk about disease.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that kind of lends into the next question I wanted to ask you, and that's, you know, specifically about female sexuality and how it's historically been really feared and repressed. And I guess you must face this in your workshops.
I see the result of that, I feel, with a lot of female clients and workshop participants. I see the effect that that has had on them and their ability to connect with their bodies, feel ownership of their bodies, mm-hmm. and
to ask,
to
verbalize what they want.
Oh, for sure, right? Yeah. I mean, even just as a retail worker in sex shops, I mean, I've helped women in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, uh-huh. who have never had an orgasm.
Oh, wow.
Right? Yeah. And you know, and it's always really amazing to be the one who's like, I want to help you get there, and we're going to get you something, and, you know, and you deserve it, and take your time and enjoy yourself. But but it's incredible, and that is definitely the legacy of that repression.
So how do you challenge that legacy when you're in your workshops or in the shop?
Well, essentially, I just try to really tell people that this is their right, that they have to really put in place some kind of mechanisms for themselves when they start to essentially hear a really negative voice telling them that they don't deserve something or that something is not for them, mm-hmm. To enjoy, that you have to really, really check that. You know, it's, you have to understand that this is something that has been historically denied to you. And when you put it into perspective, when you put it into historical perspective, it's a lot easier to not think of it as just an individual thing. I am somebody who's not deserving to, but just to then say, actually, women have been told this, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I individually do deserve this. Mm-hmm. So that's what I try to do, is try to help people to put those mental checks in place.
So you're also a burlesque performer. I wanted to ask you, as a member of a burlesque troupe, Skin Tight, Out of Sight, do you see connection between your work as a performer and also as a sex educator?
I do, for sure. I think that, especially too, as a person who has experienced a lot of weight fluctuation in front of an audience, mm-hmm. You know, I have found that people are sometimes actually surprised that I am able to enjoy my body and put it on display, and that I expect other people to find it as sexy as mm-hmm. I do. And I find that women are empowered by that, you know, that they've approached me and said, like, wow, you know, it's incredible to see just the diversity on stage, mm-hmm. and to see more than one image of beauty and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I do think of it as something that that extends to sex education as well.
And I'm sure that you might have faced some criticism in the past of sort of reinforcing these ideas about women being on display. But do you see this as a political form of participation for you?
I do. I mean, I really do. I think that being able to do it on my own terms is the most important thing. You know, if somebody else was to put me on display without my consent, mm-hmm. you know, be exploitative, that's one thing. But I feel like if I want to exploit myself and mm-hmm. get painted up and put myself out there and I'm really enjoying it and I know that it's for me, then that's another thing entirely. I feel like it's kind of a, you know, really a big, like, middle finger to everyone who's saying that I shouldn't be able to do that, that that's not something that I, as, you know, sort of an average-sized black woman, I'm not able to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. This has just been, I mean, I could talk to you for a really long time. It's wonderful meeting you and talking about these things. And thanks for being on the show with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Really glad to have been here.
That was Lorraine Hewitt, also known as Coco La Creme. She's a sex workshop instructor and also a burlesque performer here in Toronto. Thanks again, Lorraine.
Fourth, Lachine Canal. On the road, in support of their album, My Head is an Animal. Available now, special guests, Half Moon Run. Tickets on sale, Friday, March 1st at 10 a.m. 1-855-310-2525 or eventco.ca. Find out more at ofmonstersandmen.com.
Welcome back to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is now 6:17. We turn now to an update on a story we covered in the fall, the question of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in the United States. Central parts of an election law dating back to the civil rights struggles of the 1960s, the Voting Rights Act, that is, are in jeopardy today after the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a challenge to them. Today's court observers commented that they are pretty certain key provisions of the landmark 1965 legislation will be struck down. Not to be pessimistic, but given the Supreme Court's deafness to race, racism, and proactive efforts to stop the suppression of the voting power of people of color, it isn't looking good for Section 5. Passed in 1965, the Voting Rights Act is a landmark piece of civil rights legislation designed to eradicate the tactics state lawmakers invented to keep people of color from voting. The VRA bans such practices outright and puts special restrictions on states that have a habit of discrimination. Today, an Alabama county plans to argue before the Supreme Court that a key provision of the VRA has served its purpose and should now be struck down. The case, that is, Shelby County v. Holder, centers on the heart of the VRA, Section 5. This section bars certain jurisdictions, which could be counties, cities, or whole states, with a history of particularly pernicious discrimination, from enacting any changes to their voting laws without approval, or pre-clearance, as the wording is called in the act, from the federal government. Many of those states are in the South. They include Texas and Alabama, and by extension, Shelby County. The case at the fore of all of this, as I said, Shelby County and Holder, stems from 2011, when the state of Texas was preparing to redraw its electoral districts. The 2010 census showed that the state's population had swelled by more than 4 million to 26 million people. 65% of the new Texans were Latinos. The influx boosted Texas's congressional delegation by 4 seats. So by law, Texas needed to redraw its electoral districts. Lawmakers drew up the new plans. Senators who represented districts with large people of color populations were refused entry, according to a 2012 D.C. federal court ruling on the case, and they weren't allowed to see new maps until 48 hours before they were introduced on the Senate floor. Texas officials gathered data allowing them to draw a district that would look Hispanic but perform for Anglos, according to the ruling. They drew district lines to cut out a Latino representative and drew in a country club for a white representative and the school of another representative's grandchildren. They added only one new people of color majority district. 3 black and 1 Latino representative saw their offices cut out of their districts, but no white representatives did. One Texas official involved in the mapping testified that officials didn't know the addresses of the representatives' offices when they drew the map, and that their exclusion was, quote, just coincidence, a suggestion the court found, quote, not credible. The D.C. court said Texas's official testimony, quote, shows a deliberate race-conscious method to manipulate not simply the Democratic vote, but more specifically the Hispanic vote. The official's goal, the court found, was to dilute the Latino vote while making the changes appear to, quote, pass muster for the Voting Rights Act. Shelby County acknowledges the country's long history of voter discrimination, but it argues that the time has passed. Gone are the discriminatory literacy tests or poll taxes, white-only primaries, and open threats of violence against those seeking to cast a ballot of decades past. The nation just reelected its first black president, after all, and blacks have ascended to other high offices nationwide. It's time, Shelby County argues, to move on. What do you think? Should a county and the nine states covered by the Voting Rights Act, the very places deemed especially pernicious to preventing people of color from voting? Opponents of Section 5 argued that there has been constant progress on voting rights, but the last three federal elections suggest otherwise. We will continue to bring you updates on this story as the decision comes down.
Float straight out of our lids. Them, they got booed by these hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us floor rush when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He tucks the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why is it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When Butterfly rocked the light blue suede boomers. What by the cut, we push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi? Cause funks made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles and shit. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock. But I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool.
We beat the chocolates, taps on my raps. She innovates after sweet and cat naps. He at the funk club with the vibrate. Them they be crazy down with the five link. It can kick a plan, then a crowd burst. Me, I be digging it with the bug verse. Us, we be freaking till dawn, peace and I. He gets a stranger smile, so I say hi. Who understood? Yeah, understood the plans. Him heard of it and put it to his hands. What I just flip, let borders get loose. How to consume all the beaches like juice. If it's the shit, we'll lift it off the plastic. The babes will go spastic, hip-hop games are classic. Pimp playing sharp, it don't matter, I'm fatter. Axe butter how I zone.
Man, Cleopatra Jones.
And I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill.
Egyptians the world over were shocked by revelations from female activists Yasmin Al-Barmawi and Hania Mahib about seemingly systematic attacks on the women who dare to continue to protest in Tahrir Square. The horrific stories of rape and sexual assault include kidnapping and the use of knives to tear clothing and skin, as well as a video showing one woman, Hamada Saber, being dragged along the ground naked by police and kicked by soldiers outside the presidential palace. In response to these horrors, the uprising of women in the Arab world called for on February 12th a global protest at Egyptian embassies worldwide for all those who refuse to watch in silence the spreading epidemic of sexual terrorism. Here now a report from that protest and my interview with organizers Lillian Bakhtar, Amal El-Gwindi, and others.
ولا بنخاف ولا بنطاطي
ولا بنخاف ولا بنطاطي
any violence against women, especially now in Egypt, because it seems that has been in the last few weeks systematic attacks against women to deter them from participating in the revolution.
Why do you think that's happening?
Because it's happening only in Tahrir Square. They seem to be targeting the women that go to protest with the youth in Tahrir Square. So, and there has been interviews with some of the women that have been attacked, and from the way they describe it, it is organized groups that go and they target certain women to take them away and violate them.
Can you talk about the nature of these attacks a little bit?
Well, the way they describe it, it's a group of men of about 15 to 20 men will surround the woman, try to make chaos around her so no one would know what's happening, and they don't even see that there is a woman in the middle. They try to drag her away either to a secluded area and rape her, or they kidnap her. And it has been repeated, and it has been a very disturbing manner. So we are all like, it's a concern, and we are telling the women here that we support them and we are against any violations against them, whether the women in Tahrir or on the buses or in the streets or anywhere.
Can you talk a little bit about how this protest came to be?
Well, today is all over the world, in front of all the embassies and the Egyptian consulates, the women have decided to have a day of solidarity with the Egyptian women against violations against women.
And we're here today because it was a call out from women in Egypt who are sick of the sexual terrorism and the sexual violence being practiced against them, for them exercising their rights to mobilize and to protest against abuses happening to these people. So there was a call out put out last week, and we're here to support them. It's a global day, a global protest against sexual terrorism practiced against female protesters. And so we're here to say that we stand in solidarity with them. We demand the Egyptian government put into place regulations that punish people that rape and harass women on a constant basis. These thugs are really being allowed and condoned by the government, by the police, by the military. There's thugs and mobs that attack women in Tahrir and in other places where people are organizing. They attack them by the hundreds. They rape them. They stick their fingers into them. They cut them with knives. Some women have been raped with knives. Some women have actually been raped, and it makes it very difficult for anybody to come in and actually help them. Any man or woman that comes to help them, the same fate happens to them. When the women actually come out from these mob situations, many people let them into the stores because they're scared of the thugs, and also many people unfortunately think that these women shouldn't be in the protests in the first place, and so they're blaming them for being there. And so we're here to say that we're against sexual violence in Egypt, we're against sexual violence here, we're also calling for justice for the hundreds of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in Canada. And we're going to continue to stand, and the women in Egypt are saying they're continuing to stand. And they're organized. There's groups that are organizing. There's the Operation Anti-Sexual Harassment, Tahrir Bodyguards, groups like Harassmap that are coming together to put an end to sexual harassment, sexual violence, sexual terrorism against Egyptian women. And they're going to continue to organize because women have just as much right as anybody else to go out in the streets and claim their rights. And they're organized. They're against this government, and they are sick of the abuses, and they want the same demands of the revolution, bread, freedom, and social justice, and we're here to support them in that.
Do you have any idea who's behind this and what's being done by the government, if anything, to stop
it? The government is behind it. The police are behind it. The military are behind it. This is organized efforts to stop people's participation in a popular movement, which began as an organized movement 2 years ago. They overthrew Mubarak, but people have been organizing for decades, and what's been happening in the last 2 years is a result of decades of organizing. From Mubarak regime to the ruling military council to the Muslim Brotherhood, none of these entities want there to be a popular movement, want people to claim their rights, their basic rights, to fight for justice. There's so many players in Egypt. There's the U.S. There's stability for Israel. There's the Gulf. There's many, many different. different players that are creating this. But basically, all these regimes are the same. They're dictatorial. They want to keep the wealth in the hands of a few. They don't want justice for the people. And they're using all kinds of terrible methods to oppress people and make sure that they don't mobilize and they don't protest. And it's not working, because the more they push down, the more we rise up.
ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. Get a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. He says body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school and that's what I did. You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so we can fly away? We gotta make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way. So I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. Speed so fast I felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. Someone. You got a fast car. We go cruise and entertain ourselves. Still ain't got a job. Now work in the market as a checkout girl. I know things will get better. You'll find work and I'll get promoted. We'll move out of the shelter. Buy a bigger house and live in the suburbs. I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. Speed so fast, it felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone. You got a fast car. I got a job that pays all our bills. Instead of drinking late at the bar, see more your friends than you do your kids. I'd always hope for better. Thought maybe together you and me find it. I got no plans, I ain't going nowhere. So take your fast car and keep on driving. So I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. So fast, I felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us. Your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Okay, so thank you, Malek, for sharing that piece with us. So, this month, we have Ms. Christiana Collison in the studio with us. She's a fellow Spitfire member. And if I may say so myself, someone who can really spit some fire. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
So, I was just wondering if we could talk to you today about an article you wrote in the McGill Daily, which is the student-run publication at McGill. Entitled Complicating Safe Space and the Politics of Privilege and Marginality. So I was wondering if you can explain like your inspiration behind that and kind of explain what safe space is for our listeners out there.
So funny enough, my my interest in writing this piece came out of being a floor fellow. I'm a floor fellow at one of the residences at McGill. And so I'm a floor fellow at one of the residences at McGill. And currently what that means is like I just take care of the first years, whatever. And so a lot of the projects that we do with the first year is kind of like inaugurating them into McGill society, is talking about this issue of safe space. So making space accessible for all individuals, not making it classist, not making it racist, not making it ableist or sexist, etc. And problematically, my students who are mostly white take this up to mean making it comfortable, if you will. So, oh my gosh, you said something mean, safe space. No, like that's not what we're talking about. And so that's kind of where I went in thinking about writing the piece.
Okay. So safe space, one of the quotes that you had was that we all suffer from the, in brackets, same unsafeness of space, even though we don't. Can you elaborate on this point?
Okay, so when I say we don't all suffer from the same unsafeness of space, that then goes back to the same conversations that I've had with my students in residence, where, for example, they feel as though they are unsafe when people say mean things to them, or when they're challenged on an ideology that is problematically racist or oppressive, as opposed to the unsafeness of space for me as the only black female floor fellow in the community, where my students will make really, really, really racist, sexist comments about, for example, my body or body politics, talk about women's bodies in these spaces, not taking into consideration how those acts might be sexist and might and are very misogynistic, being a woman of color, then entering these spaces where I'm under attack in terms of, or experience a certain amount of violence when my students, for example, will say really, really, really problematic things about women's bodies or racial politics or identity or various other things that they, I don't want to put them on blast, but they do enough problematic shit.
So you do think in like a relation to safe space, there's like an air of ignorance around it too? Or do you think it's something that's very like out there for everyone just to understand point blank, period?
I think that there's definitely an air of ignorance around there. And I think that air of ignorance comes from this kind of, what I talk about in my article, this kind of like humanist neoliberal politics of like oppression blindness, almost, that we're all the same. We don't like, I don't see difference, et cetera, et cetera. And so in trying to make and level everyone as being all the same, what happens then is the ignorance in terms of safe space for everyone becomes the rhetoric of safe space, safe space politics, as opposed to safe space politics emerging out of the oppression of particular bodies who are marginalized in many different ways, and tailoring space to make it safe for them specifically. So I think the ignorance comes out of this kind of like neoliberal color blinding, oppression blinding frame of thought that seems to be emerging in this pseudo post-racial, post-oppression society.
So do you think there should be an alternative then to safe space if it's really erasing those lines and blurring it to the point where it's, you can't even identify or acknowledge any kind of marginalization without having to feel that it has to be covered up?
I think that's interesting, because I think the way in which a lot of students took up my article was that I was not really offering a solution to that, to safe space politics, or I was, but that solution being segregation or whatever the hell a lot of the kids thought I was doing. I think that what needs to be done first and foremost is recognizing the problems in safe space politics, and that's what I was trying to do, like right away. And then after that, going about a process of first recognizing and then critiquing the problems embedded within safe space politics, and then trying to perhaps create a new politics that is tailored specifically for individuals who experience marginality, that is rooted in a politics of intersectionality, so incorporating different forms of marginality to account for the unsafeness of space to then make space safe, if that makes sense.
Definitely, definitely. And you had mentioned that there were individuals who didn't quite agree, or they kind of questioned what you meant by that. And I'm just wondering, considering that this probably isn't the first article you've written where you've had some kind of commentary, because I know while back in December you had the All Racism Happens Because of Whiteness article, and the commentary on that was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a hot mess.
But in responding, you kept your cool, and which is very surprising. Some, like, I have one of them, which I just had to copy paste. And it's basically like, wow, why don't the black people let me be a victim too? Why they get everything?
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yes, this is
That's online, people.
I don't remember that one.
There are some really bad ones. There's another one where they're basically calling you a racist woman.
Plain-faced,
you're just the embodiment of plain-faced hypocrisy. And I'm just wondering, since we go to an institution which would, I guess, hire, like a higher,
higher
value, higher form of intellectual, you know, accommodation, if you will, why do you think there is always such a backlash when you put something that can be considered controversial or that needs to be put out there and voiced?
I think that it's because we go to a predominantly white institution where people don't, white individuals, especially with that article, don't want to give up their privilege. So being able to, like, come to terms with the fact that you are an individual who is white and you do have privilege, and recognizing that racism happens, like, not specifically because you are a white person, but that your body is attached to this corporeal kind of, like, institutionalized systemic concept that is whiteness. There's no denying that. And so your body, the skin color, invokes this privilege. Every day you walk down the street, you claim, embody, live out, and exist in this white privilege.
It's your inheritance.
Exactly. And a lot of students just don't want to come to terms with that. And I think that that's why it's perceived as controversial, or I'm this, like, racist, because I remember someone was like, oh, well, you know, you're just saying all of these bad things about me because I'm white. Well, the thing is your whiteness is like your skin color is attached to legacies, histories of oppression, colonialism, rape, genocide, violence. Get over it. Once we, you know what I mean, come to terms with that, or not we, because I've come to terms with that. They need to come to terms with that, white students at McGill. Once they come to terms with that, then we can move forward. So I don't even know if I particularly answered your question, but I guess just to think about how or why it is particularly controversial, the things that I write, I think it's because a lot of students just aren't ready to face the realities that is, like, their racism at this institution.
There was a very similar kind of backlash with the Idle No More movement and their use of the phrase settler
and settler Canadians.
And that there was a big backlash against that, of people saying, oh, you can't call me a settler, like, I've been here for such and such. And it's getting at the same thing of, no, well, what we're addressing is a legacy and a history going back generations, and that is your inheritance. And that, just like you were saying, Christiana, we have to acknowledge that and kind of, quote, get over it before we can move on to really addressing and rectifying it.
And I just, like, want to make clear, by we, I mean white students at McGill.
Yeah.
We need to acknowledge it and get over it. And then we can move on in terms of thinking. And by getting over it, I don't mean them putting your privilege in a bag, but continuing to live and exist in this privilege. But, like, critically analyzing the way in which privilege functions in the everydayness that is their lives.
Fair enough. Well, I think I have one more question for you. Just going back to this idea of privilege, how do you think privilege fits in to this idea of safe space? Because I know you had mentioned that in your article as well. And I was just wondering if you can talk about that as well.
So that I think privilege, particularly in the context of space, safe space, fits in almost inherently in the fact that when you are privileged, especially if in the sense that space is a privilege, to access space, to belong in space, to walk or run, whatever the conception is, within space is a very privileged act. It's a very, and by privileged, I mean that in its privilege, it's also very marginal. So it's, on the one hand, space is, as I talk about in my article, inherently white, inherently heterosexual, inherently male, inherently able-bodied. And in that, it means that it is, on the flip, inherently oppressive to all those who don't exist in that space. So, or exist in that, or exist within those idea, or exist within those forms of like marginality or privilege or whatever we want to title it. So that if you are, for example, a white, able-bodied, heterosexual male walking the street, never once do you have to think about the nature of space. Never once. In fact, when I was coming here, it was really funny because so many people are like kicking their feet up, getting, you know, slush on my, you know, freshly pressed high tights. And I'm like, what's going on? And interestingly enough, a lot of these individuals fall into these privileged categories. They're not thinking about how they take up space, how they belong in space, how they exist in space. And that's a privilege to not have to think about that. And being disprivileged in the ways that I am as like a woman of color who exists within or has this legacy of colonialism and slavery and rooted in her like familial, you know, ancestry or line, you think about the nature of how space is particularly tailored for bodies that aren't myself. And so that space becomes really confined or really regulated and needing to then subvert space however which way you do, or needing to exist in the space just enough so that you can survive, but not too much that, you know, you can exist in the same wavelength as that of a white, heterosexual, able-bodied male. And so privilege is, like, entrenched in the space that we exist in. Like, it's just, it's, like, rooted in the construction of space, if that makes sense.
That does. Well, thank you very much for that insightful conversation.
No problem.
And hopefully you get to come back and we have more discussion.
Anytime.
I'm going to pass it on over to Miss Victoria.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in this horribly wet evening. Does anyone have any last comments for our guest? Just going to open it before I...
It's so funny. I so appreciate Chris and all of the great commentary she's forwarding on campus. I remember when I was an undergrad thousands of years ago, so many of these exact same discussions were taking place. It's just so interesting at the same time, funny at the same time, frustrating as four-letter word, that we're still talking about this basic stuff, you know, like just being able to name things and be honest about things. So I so appreciate her and her, the strength of her voice. And I love reading her in the Daily when I'm eating lunch and taking a break from depression. I'm just kidding. I'm not depressed.
Although this space is enough to get you there, but yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that brings us to the end of the show. Just wanted to say thank you to our contributors this month, Alyssa Clutterbuck, Malek Galloway, May Nam in Toronto, Yasmin Ali, Mercedes Bonaire, and, of course, our guest, Christiana, in studio today, and Lorraine Hewitt in Toronto. And also a big shout-out to everyone who continues to support the show and who makes the show possible.
Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio at 90.3 FM, Community Radio Rocks. If you have feedback or comments for us, you can write to us at Spitfire, that's Fire, F-I-Y-A-H, at CKUT.ca, and check out our growing blog at www.spitfire.blogspot.com.
Hey!
Nothing gain, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high from the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave, and I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me, support me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream, just set the scene. Get the cream like how you mean. Straight up, one of the best days being. Ain't no puppet on a string. Like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. And just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, scheming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my mind. Taking charge, you got what it takes to make it, make it all. The world got a problem, and it's yours. That's why I wrote this rhyme. You can quote this line, cause I focus line. Living in some hopeless times, or so it seems. Never let go of your dreams, now nah, man. Nah, man. Just do what you got to do.
Do it, and do it, and do it.
Just do what you got to do.